It's October 10th, 2017. I'm Drew Messenger-Michaels, and today Gary Scheinman talks about his work on the Bioshock series, the Middle-Earth series, and lots else on the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Happy to do it.
So you are, to jump right in, because I know your time is valuable, I assume you are making the rounds because Shadow of War is about to come out. That looks pretty exciting. So my understanding, let's just get some of the logistics out of the way, is it's a very similar setup to Shadow of Mordor. You're working with Nathan Grieg again. It seems like you wrote even more music and maybe even bigger music for it this time. So since I know that's probably the main thing you're here to plug, for anybody who's not familiar, didn't play the first game, how would you describe sort of the style of the music you've written for the Middle-Earth games?
Well, I think Nathan and I developed our own unique style. I've been asked before whether we imitated some of the film scores, and to be honest, we definitely haven't, because I've never seen the movies. I saw one of the films, and that was years ago. So, and then I consciously avoided watching the films because I didn't want to have Howard Shore's music in my head. So we developed our own sort of unique style. Nathan and I write differently, and yet we have managed to both kind of find something that sounds like, you know, a score that's, from one source, shall we say. Shadow of Mordor was a very successful game. The score was successful. We got nominated for some cool awards. And so we didn't really, just like John Williams hasn't changed the style for his Star Wars films, we didn't radically change our style. But yeah, there's definitely, it's a bigger game. The music is, there's much more music because of that. And the storyline has evolved in really exciting ways, so that the music, I think, is pretty cool.
Yeah. I loved the music in the first game because it fit the setting so well, but also because, as you say, it took a very, very different direction from Howard Shore's stuff on the Peter Jackson movies. There's a lot more. I mean, there's dulcimer in your stuff. There's cool dissonances. There's an instrument that you guys used for some of the stings during the battles. I think it's called a water harp. Some of the interesting stuff you did there. And one of the things that, of course, makes what you did for the previous game, the two of you, appropriate for a game, is that it did sort of react to what the player was doing a little bit, which I found kind of interesting, because I know you've spoken in the past about how you're a little bit suspicious of game soundtracks that react too much to the player, that kind of follow their every step or their every move, how it can become cartoony or distracting. But Shadow of Mordor did that, albeit not in a cartoony or distracting way. It did it in a way that was, I think, really organic and stuff you might not even notice. There was kind of a musical flourish if you headshotted an Uruk with an arrow or something. Have you gone in maybe harder with that stuff in this game, or have you sort of stuck with it? Are you happy with how that's come out? Has your opinion maybe changed on procedural stuff?
No, it hasn't really changed. And I have no problem with game appropriate, really well done, interactive implementation. I just think it can distract if it's so interactive that every nuance of the player's, every motion is aped by the music. Then you start having the player start to play the score, definitely, I think it's really a value to have music, interactive music, that changes and that evolves as the player's activity. I think it would be, malfeasance on our part to ignore what the player is doing. So I think We achieved that. Now, Nathan implemented the music because I'm a contracted composer. I live in LA. He's up there with the Monolith team in the Seattle area. So he implemented everything. But I think our I think his implementation is not so dissimilar from the previous game, where we're definitely capturing and trying to make the player's experience feel appropriately scored, shall we say. Just as in a film. I mean, it's not manipulative to score a scene in a film where it fits the nuances of what's going on. But to go back and to your reference of what I've said before and what I'll continue to say, it's a balance. It's just a balance. Because there are some techniques that are really, really, almost cartoony, that can ape every, motion, I think that's a mistake. And I think it also drains the music of interest, because you're so focused on these implementation techniques that the music can easily be quite boring. So I think we found the right balance,
Absolutely, yeah. No, and I think, some of the games that have done the aping every motion of the player or every action of the player, done that technique well, have been games that were going for a cartoony vibe. I'm thinking of, like, The Legend of Zelda The Wind Waker, where there's, like, a giant string hit every time you strike an enemy. Or there's an indie game called Proteus, where the point is you're playing the game. Like, every step you take is a note, and there are little frogs that bounce, and there's instrumentation. Like, it produces a very different effect than the kind of large, sweeping, grand scale story you're trying to tell with the Mordor games, the Middle Earth games.
Absolutely, yeah, and in those circumstances, it's not only appropriate, it's necessary for the game's score to play every moment of the player's experience. That's a very different thing. And in fact, there is music games, of course, to go back to Guitar Hero or all those games where the music is the game. It's all about music, and the visuals accompany the music in a way, or they certainly are pretty balanced between the two. So yeah, that's great. I think I've already said it, that you can really just be too interactive, and I think you will pull the player out of the drama of the moment of the game. So that's the concern. But I think we find a great balance. Again, I don't implement. I write the music and I send it to Nate, and then Nate has a responsibility for putting it in the game. And I haven't played the game yet, so I'm looking forward to hearing how all the nuances of my work fits into the game. Then, of course, there's also the in-game cinematics, the movies, and there's a lot of them in Shadow of War. So I scored nearly an hour, probably at least an hour of in-game movies. Now, of course, that score, just like film, that music is made to order to fit the scenes, and they're really, really beautifully rendered, and the acting is great. So that was them. So I feel like I scored a movie and a game.
That's fantastic. I mean, and so obviously the scoring with something where a linear story is being told within the game, I would imagine that's quite a bit like a film, where you can develop themes and create expectations, subvert them, all those kinds of things. Is it different, though, when you're dealing with cutscenes in a game, because you don't know how much time is going to elapse between when the player sees one and when they see the next? Do you pace it differently, or do you approach it a lot like you would approach a film? Because I know you've done quite a lot of film scores as well.
Yeah, no, I approach the scene. And I'm not thinking about how much time has elapsed. I'm thinking about what's going on in the scene. Just literally playing that scene and finding the appropriate vibe to score it and to score what's going on, and also quite conscious of where you are in the game as well. I can't really think of what you would do if you knew that certain players took 30 minutes to get to that point, and another player took 2 hours. I don't know how you would rejigger your score.
Oh, sure, not the raw time so much as more in and of course I've not played Shadow of War yet, but in Shadow of Mordor, it's possible that in between two story beats, the player has fought one war chief, or it's possible they've essentially fought most of them. They've conquered the entire map. So in terms of the story of Talion, you know, gaining power, amassing power, getting ready to fight the big bad, he might be, you know, if it were a movie, those would be two very different places for him to be in his arc. That was more what I meant, not just, you know, has it been a half hour or 2 minutes or 3 seconds or something like that.
Right. Now that makes sense. I understand that. But there's no way for us to judge it. I at least was not consciously changing or thinking about that, because there's really no way to do that, you know. And even that said, when you get to that point and you see that, you know, moment unfold in the cinematic, it is what it is. It's the emotions of the visuals are what they are, and the dialogue, you know, is all set. So I can't imagine you would change that unless you were playing some, you know, unless the visuals demanded it. So it's really, I'm really just reacting to the scenes as they're presented.
Now that makes perfect sense. I guess the essence of my question also had to do with, or what I was trying to ask, I should say. If I asked it badly, that's on me. But what I was trying to get at was, do you, for the interactive section specifically, write music differently for something that's going to be a bit more open world, where the player might hear the themes, you know, more times or in more different circumstances or things like that? Or is it really just, you know, the tone of the world, the tone of the moment, the characters, the same stuff you'd think of in any other kind of story?
Yeah, it's mostly the tone. But I'm dependent, because I don't live in the same town as the development team. I'm dependent upon what Nathan gives me and tells me about that. So I'm assuming that, you know, that definitely is part of what my direction is when I'm scoring a moment. You definitely have to be conscious of the, you know, the problem that if the music loops too many times, it starts to lose its effect, you know. And in fact, I think the music should at some point go away if you have a player who's in a area of the game for too long a period of time. I think the music should just resolve itself and let the player play and only come back if there's a relevant reason for it, because otherwise I think it would start to distract.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's been a couple of, I think I saw someone ask you about this a matter of days ago, so no worries at all if you've been busy and haven't played them, but there have been some games in 2017 that have, you know, sort of tackled that problem in interesting ways. There was a Japanese game called Nier Automata that just had, I think, at least 5 or 6 or 7 variations on every big overworld theme, so that, you know, A, things could change based on what was going on, and B, it didn't get stale. And then The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild had really kind of sparse music, almost like leitmotif. Like, there was a little Link is Cold theme, there's a little Enemies Are Near theme, just little chunks of, you know, kind of dual piano stuff that fit together. You know, it seems like Shadow of War has, I want to say, a more traditional approach to a big AAA game soundtrack, but it's a tradition you yourself are largely responsible for. You've said in other interviews that you are, if not the first, then one of the first to have used an orchestra in a game soundtrack for Voyeur on the CDI, which I actually had a CDI, so I've been following your work since then, at least.
Wow.
Yeah, but...
Drew, I think you're the first person who's said to me, yeah, I had CDI.
Is that true? Okay, well, quick aside before I get back to what the question actually was, but yeah, I had a friend when I was a kid whose dad, you know, was very into gadgetry and would bring home everything and was very excited about the idea of the CDI, brought it home, and, you know, we played the terrible licensed Zelda games for that. We did get about 10 minutes with Voyeur before the friend's dad was like, yeah, you probably shouldn't be playing this, you know, 8-year-olds or however old we were. But I remember it striking me, you know, the gimmick of the CDI, even when the games weren't that good, was that the sound sounded like sound. It sounded like someone had, you know, heavily compressed, you know, the living daylights out of it, but recorded it. So as far as I've been able to tell, though it's not my area of expertise, that was the first time an orchestra was recorded for a game. There are earlier examples of instruments getting recorded. There are certainly earlier examples of voice. But yeah, I can't find an earlier orchestral thing. But all that to say,
I can't either. But I'm nervous about saying
sure,
because someone's going to come. Well, but in 1993,
right,
January 7th, you know, and prove that I'm wrong. And I just have never researched it because it's not that important to me. It's just sort of a curiosity, and it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But so I always say, because I've been asked this a bunch of times. I would say it's either the first or one of the very first, you know, because that way they can't, because it's certainly one of the very first.
Yeah, and, totally.
But likely it very well could be the first orchestral score for a video game.
Yeah, and as those kind of video tree, you know, FMV games went, it was probably the top of the game, right? Like, it was still really silly and pulpy, you know, going back and looking at it later on, but it was, you know, it was relatively well acted as those things go. The score was really on point. You look at some of the other early examples like Night Trap and stuff like that, and they're not without their charm, but they're definitely wobblier, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I don't really have any way of judging the other CDI games. I wasn't aware of them at all, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
interesting to hear your perspective on it, actually.
So some of the most infamous ones were the way the CDI came about. I probably don't need to tell you this, but for anybody listening who doesn't know it, was that originally there was going to be a Nintendo PlayStation. Nintendo and Sony and Philips were all sort of working together on this big, you know, CD-based console. The deal fell apart, and everybody kind of took their toys and went home. So Nintendo kind of took a left turn, made a cartridge-based thing, made the N64. Sony ended up making the PlayStation, and Philips, who had been working on some of the optical drive technology on the thing, kind of, you know, took their ball and made the CDI. And, you know, as a result, they had some licenses from Nintendo. So they made like a really bad game called Mario Hotel, where it was like a hotel sim thing. They made three Legend of Zelda games that had some very chintzy FMV acting in them, or at least one of them did. I think two had like hand-drawn animation. And they were not fully voice acted, but, you know, heavily voice acted. And they were a mess, right? Like, what was so interesting about the CDI era was that everybody was so entranced with these new toys they had in terms of telling stories with video or sound that they kind of frequently forgot to make a game. Like, it didn't have much rigorous playtesting. One of the Zelda games was called Zelda's Adventure, and, you know, the developers have gone on record saying they're not even sure they can beat it if they go back and play it, because it's just so janky. So what I found fascinating about those games at the time was that they just felt alien. They felt like almost literally like aliens had made them. Like, someone had come to Earth, seen what video games were like, and then with their advanced alien technology tried to ape it without fully understanding what was interesting about the medium. And it was intoxicating, you know what I mean, at the time. I didn't have the language for why, because I didn't have the language for why game design worked, but it was just, I couldn't look away.
Well, it was the Wild West back then. I mean, I don't think people were just, you know, developers were just trying to say, well, what should a game be, you know? I mean, we had sort of the early games like Pong, you know, and really simple sort of game dynamics, but all of a sudden people going, wow, it could be anything. It could be a movie,
right.
You know? And so there was this true Wild West vibe. And I had no idea the history of the three companies, Nintendo and Philips and Sony, all cooperating, and then that deal falling apart. So that's an interesting piece of that puzzle that sort of answers the question of why and how that all sort of unfolded, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And then, you know, the drama of the console wars after that, with Square Enix picking a side and the Final Fantasy games being for PlayStation, all of that was kind of the fallout of that one weird moment in history, as was the creation or the introduction of orchestral music in games. So anyway, that's the history you're part of. But the original point that I was attempting to make, and I get excited about this stuff, so my apologies if I meander, was that the style that you sort of, you know, probably the watershed moment was the first BioShock, where, again, you've gone on record as saying that when you started that project, the music wasn't thought of as integral to the game, but by the time you got through it, you know, everybody agreed that was a huge part of what made Rapture feel like Rapture and all that. That seems to me like the moment where this kind of big orchestral, I want to say cinematic, but cinematic's not quite the right word because it's not just movie music, but this big lush style of video game music writing sort of came into its own. And there are all these other branches that have popped out since then, but it seems like the Middle Earth games sort of carry on that tradition and expand on it rather than moving in some other crazy direction. Is that kind of what you meant earlier, or one of the things you meant about not reinventing the style for Shadow of War?
Well, no, I just meant that Shadow of Mordor and Shadow of War, they're related games.
Sure.
And so just like, you know, the original Star Wars, John Williams developed a style for it, and then he didn't change the style for the subsequent game.
Right,
films.
Sure.
you know, it because it really fit that world, and it
gotcha.
Does. And now every Star Wars film has an orchestral score, and it's either written by John Williams or someone sort of doing something similar.
Working so really hard to sound like him, yeah.
Exactly, and of course nobody can.
Right.
But so in that sense, we didn't feel the need or the desire to really radically change and do something, you know, 180 degrees different and go with a synth score and, you know, make the score something completely different, because it would have been inappropriate. It wouldn't have felt right or organic to what they were producing. So just like they didn't, you know, they didn't nix the Talion or Celebrimbor characters, we didn't nix the style of our score. We just developed it. I think it's a better score. I think we definitely just, you know, took the time. We had the resources to produce it beautifully, and you get better. I think, you know, I'll say this, I think my score for BioShock 2 may be the best BioShock score.
I was about to bring that up. When I first played BioShock 2, I was kind of shouting it to the hills along with Lucio, the other guy who's on this podcast. We both loved that game, and we're telling everybody that specifically the score, which was something everyone loved about the first BioShock, was maybe like it did more with the ideas. It was more developed, and people thought we were crazy. And of course now that Jordan Thomas and some of the other folks who've worked on that game have moved on to make other indie games, and people are aware of their talents, I think people are more open to the idea that BioShock 2 is incredible. But your work on that is just amazing. It's some of my favorite stuff you've ever done.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, I was scoring that literally at the exact same time as I was scoring a game called Dante's Inferno, and that had a pretty interesting score as well. So I would write one cue for one game, and then I'd go to the other game and write a cue for that, and go. But I think they're different, quite different in tone.
Extremely. Dante's Inferno is a game that I think your score was probably my favorite part of it. Like I did enjoy the game, but I thought it was a bit of a mess. You don't have to comment on that, but it was one of those interesting messes. In the same way that when you look at those CDI games, it's like, well, whether or not this gets a 10 out of 10 or whatever, I've never played anything quite like this. And a huge part of that was like, I mean, like, what an incredible thing to get to write for Hell. Like, that's a yes. Really, really cool aesthetic challenge, and I think you rose to it.
Thank you. So I think, it is interesting, but going back to the BioShock 2, I felt like I understood the style, and then I refined it in a cool way. So BioShock, the score, I think, was more of a breakthrough in terms of, you know, using new techniques to score film, games rather. But BioShock 2, I didn't reinvent the wheel, but I refined it in a cool way. And you know, John Williams, a lot of people don't think that the original score for Star Wars was his best. His subsequent scores were better. I keep bringing up John Williams. I'm not comparing myself to him because he's such a unique genius. But I think it's relevant to make that analogy. So yeah, I think, you know, once you sort of develop the style, then you can think about it and you can refine it, you know. And I think they refined the game in some ways, but the thing about the original BioShock is you had the genius of Ken Levine on it. So the story was so cool and so interesting, and it was, and no one had seen anything quite like it. It had a unique vibe to it, you know, which is what drove its popularity, I think, you know. And then so BioShock 2 didn't break those, you know, those old barriers. It just refined it in a really, really great way. So,
yeah, games are an interesting medium, and they're a bit like music, and specifically classical music, in a sense that I don't think it's acknowledged that much, which is people celebrate innovation, but what lasts is sometimes iteration. You know, like not necessarily being the first, but taking an idea and expanding upon it.
Exactly. And a great example of that is Bach. You know, Bach did not create the Baroque, you know, style of writing, you know, writing music of that era. He refined it. His genius was that he took it and he created like the ultimate artistic baroque, you know, or music of that era. Not baroque. He just refined the crap out of it and wrote and it's only his music, pretty much, except for maybe Handel, that is really, really remembered from that era, you know, and is regularly performed because he just was such a genius. But he didn't, you know, he didn't invent the fugue or any of the other, you know, styles that he was writing. He just took it to its ultimate genius level, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's and there are certain, you know, figures who sort of did both. I mean, like Mozart introduced stuff and refined it, but, you know, aside from those kind of transitional figures, maybe Beethoven, maybe similar too, right? Like he started out aping Mozart and then, you know, ended up doing his own thing. So there's versions of it that are rough and we celebrate that because it's interesting, and there's versions that are glorious by the time you get to like the Ninth Symphony or something. That, you know, so some people do both, but it is given to most artists either to innovate or to refine. And I think you're right that it's the ones that refine and perfect that tend to leave the biggest mark, you know, over a long enough time frame.
Right, and I'm sorry. It is, of course, the Baroque era.
I was doing the same thing of like, is it not Baroque? I totally thought Bach was Baroque.
It is, of course, the Baroque era. Yeah.
I was breaking my brain trying to think if there was some better term for it if I was about to be schooled, because you know people casually call all this stuff classical music, but of course you know there's all these eras that are not actually the classical era folded into it. So,
you know, I don't know if you heard of a composer named P.D.Q. Bach.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, he does a whole comedy. It's a contemporary composer who does a whole comedy routine. And I remember when I was at USC many, many years ago, he came to the campus and he had a piece of music that he, of course, USC is known as the Trojans. That's our motto, you know, our character, Tommy Trojan. And so he had a piece of music called Baroque and Trojan. So play on, of course, the... No, I don't need to take it further.
No, not at all. I mean, I love P.D.Q. Bach. My mom is a giant classical music nerd, and I grew up with all this stuff. P.D.Q. Bach is something she introduced me to at a young age, the coffee filter cantata and all that stuff.
Yeah, Peter Schickele.
Yeah, I later, you know, as a teenager and stuff, I got into his stuff as Peter Schickele. Maybe it's a good transition to talk a little bit about Bioshock Infinite, because I'm a real chump for any music that endeavors to sound American. And some of Peter Schickele's non-P.D.Q. Bach stuff, he has like the American Dreams string quartet that has some of it's like, you know, cribbing from Aaron Copland's playbook. It's like chordal harmonies and stuff like that. But it's also attempts to sound rustic, or like it's, you know, it's a string group up in the mountains. And I think some of the stuff that you did for Bioshock Infinite, not that it sounds like Peter Schickele or that it's aping any one person in particular. I don't think it does. I don't think it is. But it has some of those same ideas in it. The idea of what it means to sound American, what it means to sound open, what it means to sound, you know, adventurous in that context, those kind of things. And that's part of what I love about your work there too.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, I didn't even think of his music in any reference to that. And I'm not familiar with that part of his genre. I know his PDQ music, which is, you know, comedy, classical comedy, shall we say. And I know he's also a serious composer and has written a lot of really amazing music. But I'm going to go check out some of that stuff because it's relevant to what I did. But yeah, I mean, I obviously, if you've played Bioshock Infinite, it's set in that era, 1912, I believe, and it's this overtly sort of like, you know, image of America if it had gone in another direction and gone towards a very evil direction, you know. So it takes the styles of popular music, including Stephen Foster and sort of infuse it into the score, you know.
Yeah, there's that one track in Infinite that's extremely Stephen Foster influenced. I think it's called Lighter Than Air. Yes. It's got that really beautiful melodic thing. And then there's of course the Bioshock menacing dissonant strings under it. But and that to me is what I think defines the Bioshock sound. This is something I've heard you talk about too, is like how you figured it out. It's that Americana of the two different eras, you know, crammed together with that really intense, menacing horror movie stuff. Like it's such a unique sound.
Thank you. Yeah, it was really, that was a real honored to score, and obviously it was a very successful game, and I won some awards. It was all good, but it took a while because that Ken Levine definitely did not want to retread BioShock and BioShock 2 music. He wanted something quite unique and different, and so it was an interesting challenge to come up with that.
Definitely. So one other question, as long as we're sort of talking about the BioShock sound.
And it is the 10th anniversary.
It is. Oh, man, that's true. Yeah, I got to revisit those games. I've played them all, but I've played them all once through. I'd love to go back and just kind of experience the whole thing again. And Infinite, was just aesthetically impeccable, right? I've talked on this podcast and other places about the narrative thing and how it isn't about what you think it's going to be about and what's the effect of that and all those kind of things. But just inhabiting that world is something that I think is a uniquely excellent experience. I was just going to say, I've heard you talk before, and I'm making an attempt here, by the way, just to put my cards on the table, to get you to talk about stuff you haven't necessarily talked about in other interviews, for your sake as well as the listeners. But one thing I've heard you say two things, and I'd like to see if I can connect these dots. One thing I've heard is that when you first joined BioShock 1, the initial thought was that it was going to be a little less of an admixture than it ended up being, that it was just going to be sort of ambient, menacing music, and the music concrete stuff and the period stuff sort of came in later. I've also heard you say that one of the games you admire a lot is Portal. And I find that kind of interesting because I've heard you talk about Portal, and I love Portal. My MA thesis was actually on Portal. But I've never heard you really talk about the music. And sort of listening back to the Portal 1 soundtrack, it occurs to me that it is very much like the way you describe the original idea for the BioShock music. It is just sort of menacing, presumably more electronic than you would have, gone with BioShock. But it's got that kind of undertone. I wonder if you consider the music in Portal specifically an influence, or if you did anything with that, or if it's more just, that you admire the game and the music, the musical part of it is, if not incidental, at least not at the center of what you like about it.
Yeah, I think Portal is just a brilliant game. I just think it's such an amazing, it's just so much fun. When you play it, the music, I think, brilliantly helps the player and helps the vibe of the game, but it's not the kind of music that you would necessarily perform on a concert in the stage.
Right,
it's
right.
Very ambient, and it's totally appropriate for the game, and I think that they did a great job. But I do think that BioShock is, I think they're just really different games,
Oh,
now,
for sure.
I don't think Portal existed when I scored BioShock, I'm pretty sure. And certainly I didn't start working on BioShock thinking that this music needs to be really ambient. My direction from Emily Ridgway, who's the audio director, was to create something really, really unique and not sound like any other game or film or television score. But I found that subsequently from Ken that he initially didn't think the music was going to be much different from
System Shock. Yeah,
exactly. So, and System Shock, I don't know if it had, I never played System Shock, to be honest, but I think it had some ambient sounds. So I think that was his idea, and he wasn't too focused on music. I got very few notes from him, many more notes on when I worked on BioShock Infinite. So he was just sort of like, the music is sounding fine. But and then towards the end of the game, he wrote me some really cool, emails and things saying that it changed his mind about how music could help and work with a video game. And I was very proud of that. I felt like I'd really achieved. He was, in a way, he's like an audience of one.
Sure. And a receptive audience, and an audience whose opinion you respect, which is
exactly
the best kind.
So it was really cool to have both of them.
Yeah. No, and so, quick fact check. BioShock came out about a month or two before Portal did. So okay. The two games would have been in development at the same time. And I guess, you know, the menacing ambient thing was more just something in the water for games at the time, because that is exactly, you know, what the music in System Shock 1 and 2 is like. And that's what first-person games, first-person horror game shooters, etc. sort of sounded like. I mean, Valve's earlier stuff with the Half-Life games, you know, either there would be no music or there would just kind of be menacing sound effects and ambiance and hum.
Exactly. So I had no influence from Portal at all. It would have been impossible. They were
right.
But I was aware that System Shock had that sort of very ambient. But I'll give Emily Ridgway credit then for really pushing for a more substantial vibe to the score, and it just needed it. I mean, you know, I suppose you could have played BioShock with total ambient kind of vibe. And but I don't think it would have been the same game. I think
would have been so weird. And even if you had the licensed songs, but then the stuff in between was just ambient, it would have been such a different game. It would have had a completely different tone to it.
And the game has such a personality, you know. It's full of personality. And I think I got to play one of the characters in the game, you know, one of the cool, fun characters that make the game so cool, you know.
So that I did not know. I will look that up and I will listen for it on my replay that I'm now planning. That's really cool. Do you want to say which one, or should we let that be a surprise for people?
No. When I say that, I mean its own unique character.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Got it.
Yeah, it was its own unique character in the game, you know.
Yeah.
That you weren't necessarily thinking of in that terms, but really kind of brought its own vibe. I was permitted the opportunity to have the music play a really cool role in the game, you
100%.
Know. And yet, if when you play the game, it's not wall-to-wall music at all. You know, it's just in key moments where the music gets to really, you know, play its part. And it was interesting because, you know, one of the things initially, Emily did not want to have any combat music. But after I was, there was one bit of combat music was when you're trying to, you know, win the ultimate boss battle at the end against,
against Atlas.
Atlas, exactly. Yeah. So there was, I wrote that. But other than that, when I was done, I got a call and they said, we need combat music. So I wrote several combat cues that they could, you know, include in the game. So they realized, yeah, we need, this will really improve some of these action sequences and drive the adrenaline of the player and really, you know, make it cool when this music is helping these really critical combat moments.
I think that is the number one thing you would have lost, you know, because I think the overall effect of violence to ambient music is that the game is telling you you're supposed to be joyless about this or depressed, or sometimes it's a have your cake and eat it too kind of, you like violence, don't you, kind of thing. But to let you get swept up in those moments of combat, I think is really key to what BioShock does and whatever switches and twists it does offer to sort of complicate that wouldn't work as well if the violence weren't exciting and fun.
Yeah, no, that's a good analysis of it. As I am in almost every game I've worked on, was a contracted composer in another city where the game was made. So I wasn't playing the game each day. I wasn't sitting there playtesting and going, wow, this is lackluster without combat music. But somebody was and said, you know, yeah, we need some action here. We need something to drive the adrenaline of the player. And so, you know, those are all the aesthetic decisions that people make, you know, when making a game or a film or a television show or any art or, you know, entertainment. Those are all human decisions, and people make good decisions or bad decisions. And I think the reason BioShock's, you know, considered a classic is because they made a lot more good decisions than bad ones. You know, I can't think of any really bad plays. I mean, I think, you know, Ken will say that the Atlas fight at the end was not the best moment in the game, that it could have ended better. I've actually heard him in interviews say that he felt like the end was the least interesting part, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when people say that Rapture was their favorite character in the game, you know, first of all, whether they know it or not, they're talking about your music a lot of the time. But I think the ending, and yeah, I've definitely heard Ken Levine talk about this in interviews, the ending is strange because you're in this leaky underground city, and it's sort of promising that the cataclysmic event will be a flood, you know, it's just sort of implicitly or tonally or something, and then instead the cataclysmic event is a big blue guy. It's not that it doesn't necessarily work, it's just, it's very odd, you know, tonally. It's a huge tonal shift in a game that already has some very intentional tonal shifts. I think that's what people find strange about it, you know?
Yeah, and it's sort of it's not unusual. It falls into, you know, sort of a routine way of a video game conclusion. The big boss battle at the end, you defeat the big boss at the end, and you're done. You know.
Yeah, and in a game that felt so different from other games in so many ways, for it to be kind of rote like that, yeah.
Exactly. So I think that was the one area that could have benefited from the overall aesthetic, which was so brilliant and so, you know, amazing. And it didn't ruin the game. It just could have been even better. That's all.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, that game was delayed, and I know there was a lot of pressure to finish that game, as in every game, you know, because you can go on and on and iterate and change and fix and, you know, but it cost a lot of money, you know, and nobody at 2K certainly knew that the game was going to be the classic that it became. It was just a cool game, and they're making it, and they go, it's got to be finished, you know. So we've got to get it out there and hopefully sell some units to justify all this, you know, expenditure.
Right. Well, and my understanding, you know, from what I've read, obviously as an outsider, is that problem was maybe compounded with Infinite, that there was a lot of pressure and that it went through a lot of iteration. So first of all, my understanding about your process with Infinite is that it was a bit different than your standard contracted composer, where you actually, you didn't like write the music and mock it up with synths and then get the orchestra in at the end, as is common. You actually had sessions, what was it, every couple of weeks or something with the string players? So you, I would assume, were sort of more involved in to my understanding, the very deep and very frequent changes that were made to the real substance of that game throughout the process.
Well, I mean, I wasn't making decisions because I'm a contracted composer.
Sure, totally.
So you have Jim Bonney was the music director, and so he was on, you know, Johnny on the spot there, you know, giving me direction about what's happening. I could repeat this story. I've told this story before, but the game was premiered publicly at E3, and I forget what year that was. I was there. I was at E3, and the character Elizabeth was in the game demo that was played there, and it became the thing that all the press was talking about: Elizabeth, 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 and it really caused Ken and the whole team to rethink, because she wasn't that central. To go, she's way more central than we think. You know, it kind of became obvious that she was central. So they rethought the game, you know. And you get, it takes a lot of courage, I think. I think it really takes a lot of courage for a team. I think that's true of any of our lives. You know, we make some decision and we're going with it, you know, and all of a sudden to like go, wait a minute, maybe we're in the wrong direction, or not the wrong direction, but we need to veer, you know, 90 degrees here. And so to do that and to, you know, take the time and to rethink it was a really strong and a great decision. And that's, you know, I wasn't there. I'm assuming Ken was driving that almost entirely, you know. And so that's where his genius really comes in. He did that. And it was interesting. It was when I was like, on the game for several months and trying out different experiments and trying different directions. And I hadn't really quite found the style, but it was when I heard that Elizabeth was now the central focus that I wrote the Elizabeth theme. And when Ken heard that, he loved it. And that really, and at the time I go, okay, great. I finally found the direction for this score. And then I started thinking about it, go, well, it makes total sense. They didn't quite know what their game was. And how can you score a game when you don't know what the real central storyline is about? And when they discovered it, I could write now I can really score this game. So that all made sense to me in thinking about it in retrospect. But at the time, it was just like, oh, okay, Elizabeth is, let me write some music for Elizabeth because she's so central now to this game. And but that really was the, you know, epiphany of how the score should unfold.
Absolutely. And Elizabeth's theme is some of the best writing in that game. It's really, really beautiful. And I did not mean to let you down by making you tell a story you've told before, by the way, making a good faith attempt to avoid that. But I think it's a really interesting story because when you play Bioshock Infinite, when I play it, I should say, I'll make it personal. I can tell that it's a really, like, the ambition shows through first and foremost, but it's got the deep scars of something where the creators had the courage to completely change the direction halfway through. And it's like, it shows, and it's really appropriate to the theme of the game, you know, without getting into spoilers for anybody, right? To see, you know, the scars of multiple possibilities, you know, come through. And I did not mean, you know, by asking, you know, how involved were you in those changes, but my intent was not, you know, like what share of the blame do you, that's not where I was going at all.
No,
I was more just,
I don't want to take too much credit for it either.
Yeah, exactly.
I wasn't there. I wasn't making those decisions. I wasn't the guy in the meeting and said, you know, we should make this about much more about Elizabeth.
Right, right.
I was just here going, it's much more about Elizabeth now. And I go, oh, okay, well, and I read, I'm going to write an Elizabeth theme. But no one asked me to write the Elizabeth theme. That said,
right.
I went and actually on my own dime recorded with live musicians. And it was also when I realized that the passion of the performance was really critical to Ken's, you know, appreciation of it. So I said, you know, what if I just go in? Because there was plenty of budget for that, for the music. And since it started to become obvious that small string ensembles was the direction, then we didn't have to spend money. The most expensive thing in a music budget, if you have an orchestra, is the orchestra. Because that's a real, you have like 60, 70, 80 musicians out there. That every minute is like a super expensive budgetary moment. So if instead of having 60 or 70 players, you have four, you know, then you can do a hell of a lot of, you can make a lot of mistakes in the score and it doesn't matter. So you can go in for 3-hour session every few weeks and you still have budget galore. So it didn't break the budget. So that's when I said, let me just go in and let's just score it this way. And that turned out to be like a really good decision. I don't know if that will ever occur again in my experience, but it was uniquely right for that.
The freedom that comes with not working with a whole orchestra, but with a more targeted. It was 10 string players or something like that for every track.
It ended up being 10. At first, I just would use 3 string players, and then 4, and then 8, and then I thought, you know, it would be really cool to have like, because like with strings, 2 is not a good, 2 strings on a note is not a good thing, because if any intonation issues are really exaggerated, you know, one on a note is fine, but 3 on a note is better. So I had 3 violins, 3 violas, 3 celli, and 1 double bass, and that was a really cool ensemble. And I had fantastic musicians playing here in LA, and that became the vibe. And I would say most of that music that I recorded live became what was in the game.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you to get that really big sound, you would double that sometimes, right? Like for the
sometimes I would double it, for the combat music, I found the doubling actually made it less intense, which was an epiphany for me, because I just thought the more the better, you know, let's make it, you know, but it wasn't the fact, because it kind of took the raw edge off of the performance that they got. And, you know, so that's, we ended up going with the sort of single pass versions of the combat music, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just more for the listener than for you. I will link to a GDC talk in the bottom with a couple of the folks who worked on the music for Bloodborne, talking about how they had a bunch of different composers who were all working with the same set of instruments, strings, Celeste, I forget what else, whatever they decided sounded like a horror movie set in the Victorian era. And the challenges they had with like trying to get the feel of the mock-ups, which sometimes said, you know, give me, you know, three double basses or something, to actually make that sound correct on a real instrument. Sometimes you had to mess around with octaves, and sometimes you had to change, you know, whether the doubling was there or not, and the interesting things of what creates energy and what doesn't. So anyway, I'll link to that because I think it's relevant. But I think that your string writing in Infinite is fascinating. And again, the main reason I wanted to ask about the iterative stuff is I'll bring it back to John Williams. He has this great story about how when he was working on the first Star Wars movie, he wrote this really romantic theme for Luke and Leia, you know, because George Lucas had not told him that they were going to turn out to be brother and sister. So it's like, so, you know, he had to sort of work around this big lush romantic theme in the later films, you know, with this reveal where, you know, if you knew the entire story ahead of time and you knew it was going to be a trilogy, you might want to plant the seeds of the reveal earlier on. But it kind of adds these layers accidentally, right? So that's, I guess, what's fascinating to me is the idea of, you know, writing music for a project that is in flux and having to adjust to that. And it seems to me that having multiple sessions to record and get that energy would make that potentially more chaotic, but also really exciting.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, it's like, I don't know if you know the composer John Cage, you probably do, mm-hmm. but it's you know, it's just sort of like how chance can make a really interesting, amazing contribution to a work of art, you know, I'm doubting that Lucas even knew that they were brother and sister in the first film.
Yeah,
I don't think anyone thought there'd be a second film, you know? And if you read anything about the history of making that movie, it was just a space movie. It was a low budget space movie that it became this iconic, you know, billion-dollar industry.
It became an industry unto itself. That's a very good way to put it.
No one would have predicted. And so, on a much different level, BioShock, no one thought there was going to be more BioShocks or that it was going to become, you know, iconic. You just don't know that when you're making it. You have no way of knowing that. And things that you think, like, I thought Dante's Inferno had a chance to do that, you know, and then it just didn't. It was successful enough, but it wasn't successful enough to make sequels, which I was hoping for, you know.
If you'd gotten to make like a Purgatorio game or something, that would have been fascinating. Yeah,
that would have been cool. But you just don't know that, and usually whatever you predict is wrong. You know what I mean? It's just like you can't. Those are sort of impossible things to predict. If you could predict that kind of stuff, then well, then it'd be best for us to hang up right now and go to the racetrack.
right.
Start betting lots of money because we know who's going to win the fourth, you know, in Santa Anita.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you have like the sports almanac from Back to the Future 2 or something like that. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it is different though because, you know, when you're working on something like Star Wars or BioShock that becomes bigger than it was originally going to be, it is different from, you know, what Howard Shore got to do on his Lord of the Rings score where he knew he was scoring three movies up front. You know, it's just, I would imagine as a composer, you approach those two situations differently because if you think you only have one work to tell a complete story and you have to leave it all on the field, so to speak, I would just imagine it's like I feel like now that everything's a franchise, sometimes stuff gets spread a little thin. I think about this a lot with the Marvel movies. You know, none of those heroes really have like a big theme you could hum in the same way that Superman does or the Tim Burton Batman movies did or things like that. And I have to think it's because they're, you know, spreading stuff a little thinner over what's supposed to be an infinite number of movie franchise. There's something to be said for focusing completely on the work you're working on.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, you know, I think the attack on the Marvel movies is that they are sort of cookie cutter, you know, McDonald's.
Don't get me wrong, I like them, but I think there is some truth to that criticism.
They're big budgeted, well made, but they're not meant to stand alone. You know, they're just sort of like next, and they expect it to make money with them.
Well, they're more like comic books in that sense. You know,
yeah, and so it's like, yeah, it's they're more like what they originally came from, and therefore you don't want the score so iconic that it, you know. You know, they kind of have a formula. It's a formula. And so if it doesn't fit into the formula, then, you know, there's a problem with it. You know what I mean? So I think that sort of muffles the potential for the scores to become iconic, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So you work all the time, if your IMDb page is any indication. And I know you play games. I know that you've said you really enjoy playing through the BioShock games and stuff you work on. You've mentioned Portal. I heard an old interview where you said you were playing Plants vs. Zombies. I know you play games with your son a fair bit. Have you played anything lately that really impressed you, musically or otherwise? Or have you mostly been head down in work lately?
I've been head down. I haven't played. I'm trying to think if there's anything. I've played some Minecraft with my son. He's been into Minecraft, and that's a really wonderful, amazing world, you know. But no, I kind of wish I were, but I haven't played any games that I could really, like, you know, say this is incredible. I'd like to. But I've been too busy.
Yeah, totally. I think I read an interview where somebody like said that he emailed you a giant folder of soundtracks at the end of the interview or something from all the amazing games.
Yeah, I said he was like talking about all these. What about this? What about that? And he sent me all these links, and I go, okay, that's cool. I want to hear what you think is amazing, you know. And so that was cool to get his take on it. Anyways, you know.
Yeah, and it ranges from stuff that is. I wouldn't say similar to your music, but similar in intent, you know, lush, emotionally resonant orchestral music, to stuff that's nothing like what you do, like the Persona 5 soundtrack, which is, you know, very, very broadly like jazz fusion kind of stuff. It's been a hell of a year for games in general and game music specifically.
Yeah, I think so. It's bad. It's really, I think some of the most interesting music right now is coming out of games, but not television and films. I think television is in a really interesting golden era, but I don't think television scores are in a golden era. They're very ambient, you know. similarly with films, there's certainly some great film scores being produced, but they don't seem to be entering the zeitgeist, you know, of what the time is. So I think in some ways, the game scores are pretty interesting.
Yeah, the only two television shows I could think of off the top of my head where the music is central to what, you know, people think of when they think of it would be Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which is explicitly a musical, and then Steven Universe, which is a cartoon that is sometimes explicitly a musical but also has this kind of combination chiptune other stuff soundtrack. I can't think of much else. Did you have another example there that I talked over?
I think Game of Thrones has a.
That's a very good point. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And they do interesting, ambitious stuff too. With like they have that big theme that everybody knows, and the Lannisters have a theme. But then, you know, two seasons ago, I guess it was, they started, you know, messing around with all that kind of piano stuff. Like Cersei's theme sounds completely different from the rest of the show. It's interesting. They can
especially since the piano wasn't invented in that.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. That had not occurred to me. But yeah, that's part of why it's so jarring, is it's so anachronistic. But it also just is completely outside of the reality of, you know, because they've done stuff that's not period before. There's been like electric guitar and stuff, I believe.
But, right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, think of the score for 300.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Yeah.
That certainly takes that fully in that direction, and yet it worked, you know. So.
Yeah. 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 I mean, to take it back to the Middle Earth games, I think something you do, and I know you don't want to be compared, but I'm going to go ahead and compare you. One thing I like, perhaps even better than Howard Shore's approach to that world, about your approach to that world, is that it feels like the soundscape comes out of that time and place. You know, the kind of the quick strikes and stuff like that feels a little bit more medieval, and it's the way the dissonance gets used feels like you're on a smoky battlefield, or someone's playing an instrument that's you know, foreign to you or something like that. It feels a little bit more sort of misty and mythic than his stuff does. His stuff is more just, you know, anthemic and things like that. I really, really liked that approach in the first game, and I'm excited to hear it in the second.
Yeah, and we went in, I went into a studio and recorded all these really wonderful primitive instruments, you know, including playing shells, blowing through shells and blowing through animal horns and femur bones and the Aztec death whistle and all these. We just captured all these really cool sounds that we then used sort of as a sound, our own unique sample library to add to the various tribes and orc tribes.
I feel like you just gave me 5 Wikipedia pages to link. What is an Aztec death whistle?
Oh, it's pretty cool. It's like a clay skull that you blow into, and it's this really spine-tingling scream almost.
Huh.
It's a really cool sound. If you Google it, or if you YouTube search, you'll hear it. It's cool.
That is amazing. I will definitely do
it's
that.
Like a scream. It's like it has an almost human-like scream quality, and that's what's so cool about it. And it is, it's an old Aztec instrument, and I don't quite know the history of it, excepting that it's called the Aztec death whistle.
Yeah, and they, I mean, you know, there was a culture certainly interested in death in a bunch of different ways, and yeah.
They were known for, if you ever saw what's that movie, Apocalypto?
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, not precisely the most historically accurate film, but in terms of tone, certainly captured something. So did you draw from a whole bunch of different sort of cultural sounds and traditions to get the flavors for the different Uruk tribes?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely did, including we even like on one tribe that has this sort of royal quality. I mean, I used a harpsichord.
See, that's awesome. So the thing about Tolkien that can make it tough for a modern audience, or one of the things, right, is that it really is, like, the racial politics of it suck, you know? There is this group of people who are genetically evil and irredeemable. There are these mercenaries that are definitely coded as, like, Asian or Middle Eastern or something like that, who are fighting on behalf of the evil people. And some adaptations of Tolkien, you know, earlier Hobbit movies and stuff like that, keep that coding in place. So it's really, really neat to me that you can code the Uruks as having all these different qualities or something like that without all of it being like, oh yeah, it all comes from South America because they're evil. Like, no, it comes from all over. It just comes from the ancient world or a time forgotten, right? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. I think we were happy to borrow and steal from anywhere we could.
Totally, yeah.
If it felt like it really... fit in some way, because what really fits is ultimately it's an intuitive, you know, it's a combination of intellectual and intuitive, you know. Mm-hmm. And something that may seem incompatible just works for some cool, amazing, interesting reason, you know. So that's it. You just go, well, I think that's going to work, and I think that's really cool, and you know, there's a consensus, and then you go with it, you know.
Yeah, and that's one of the best things to me about genre fiction generally, and fantasy specifically, is you can kind of smash together all this stuff from like a shared history of humanity and make it make sense together in a way that it couldn't in a more naturalistic setting, you know.
Exactly. If you're trying to be totally accurate or somehow, but how do you be accurate about orcs? They don't exist.
Right. Well, that's the thing, right? There wouldn't have been pianos in Westeros. It's like, well, Westeros has been Westeros for thousands of years because their history stopped because they had dragons instead of guns and, you know, and things like that. Like, you have a certain amount of license where if the internal logic makes sense, you can go a lot of interesting places.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, if you need to go, no worries whatsoever.
I should go, but it's been a pleasure chatting with you, Drew.
Oh man, likewise.
Knowledge is so encyclopedic, it's fun. This interview is one of the better ones I've had, because I think your depth of knowledge is that some, you know, you I don't some of the people who interview you do not obviously know the history of and have not read any of my previous interviews, but you really know your stuff, and that I think that makes your work pretty cool.
Well, thank you very much for that. I really appreciate that. I try to at least do the 15 minutes of Googling that's going to make the interview not painful for the guy being interviewed, but also, you know, I'm talking to you about this stuff because I'm interested in this stuff, and you didn't
know we were going to talk about CDI.
That's true.
So I mean, you obviously just knew your history of so that's pretty cool.
Awesome. Well, this was an absolute pleasure for me as well, and thank you so much. I'll send you a link in case you want to link to it on your social media or anything like that. Where can people find you on the internet? Is there anything besides Shadow of War you want to plug?
I'm working on a game right now, but I can't, you know, the game industry is super secretive, so I can't talk about it. It is a VR game.
That's awesome. Cool.
Orchestra and record it right here in LA, which I haven't been able to do for a while because of Union, AF of M. I don't want to get into that because it's, you know, probably not interesting to anybody but us composers and musicians. But I'm able to record that in LA, and my favorite place to record in the whole world. And excited about that.
Yeah,
and you can go to my website, GaryShineman.com.
Cool, absolutely. I will link to that.
And incidentally, my website is my name.
That was very good of you to grab that, because if you have a name of any note and you don't own it, it becomes something very weird very quickly, from what I've heard. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Gary Scheinman. Really, really appreciate your time, and I'm really excited to play the game.
Great.
And I should say games, because whatever your VR project is, I'll keep an eye on that.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
And that's the show. Middle Earth Shadow of War is out today on PC, PlayStation 4, and Xbox One. Gary's future VR project will presumably be available at some point in the future on some non-zero number of VR-enabled platforms. You can find everything Gary has done and what he's up to currently on his website, GaryShineman.com. That's GarrySchyman.com. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Podcasts, or as a rare role in premium podcast loot boxes. Or, I suppose, at etao.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.